The Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. Thanks for doing that. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's your producer. Mondays, we talk to Elise Glink. It's Tuesday, but let's take a little of her time today. Hey, Elise, let's talk about these home prices. What are the numbers on this?
This is unbelievable, John, but S&P Case-Shiller reported that home prices went up, get this, 20% in March on an annualized basis. That is even higher than last year when we were reporting that it went up 18.5%, 19%. We're now at 20%. And in places like Boise, Idaho, home prices have risen 62% in 2 years.
I knew that Idaho was a hot market. So 20% is the national number?
20% is the number for 20 of the top metro areas. So S&P Case-Shiller takes a look at the composite 10, as they call it, which are the 10 biggest markets, and the composite 20, which are the 20 top performing markets. And those include like Atlanta, Boston, Charlotte, Chicago, Cleveland, you know, the usual suspects. You don't get too small. I think the smallest is maybe Minneapolis, Portland, and San Diego. And, you know, they look at these different composites and they look at where they were this year versus last year. They also look at it on a month-to-month basis. But the one-year change is just astonishing. And in places like, you know, I don't know, Phoenix, up 32% in a year, we haven't seen numbers like that since the Great Recession. And we saw them in reverse for Phoenix, and then it started to come back up, and then it kind of normalized, and now we're seeing that again. Tampa was up 34%, almost 35% year over year.
What was it in Chicago?
Well, you know, as usual, we're bringing up the rear. So Chicago, Minneapolis, and even New York, we can talk about that in a moment, had the lowest growth, but it was still 13%, which I'll point out is several points above the rate of inflation, more than you would expect in a typical real estate market, which is obviously this has been anything but the last 2.5 years.
I thought it had cooled off. Yeah, I mean, listen, you'll take 13%. Forget about Atlanta for a minute. How do you feel about 13% growth in a year on an annualized basis? To what are you attributing all of that?
Well, this was in March, so we're now in June. So this is, you know, first quarter numbers, and we were just starting to see interest rates, rise and rise and rise. So what's happening here, John, is a little bit of a misnomer. It's not as though it's the whole housing market, because people who are at the low end are starting to get priced out. First, there aren't any homes that are what I would call low-end prices anymore in major metropolitan areas, even including Chicago. Very hard to find homes that are priced at $50,000 or $70,000 a year. And you're also seeing interest rates price people out. So when you've got interest rates that are 5.5%, 6% or higher, if your credit score is lower, you're really not going to be able to afford as much either. And so those two forces are working against lower priced property in these top 20 markets. On the other hand, think of all the multi-million dollar homes you're hearing for sale. Even in Chicago, the number of $4+ million homes, I think, has already hit a record high, or it's near a record high, just in terms of the sheer number of these homes being sold. 20 years ago, it was hard to find a $1 million home for sale. Today, it's super easy to find a $1 million home. And so when you're looking at median prices or average prices, those numbers get significantly higher. And I think that's what we're seeing happen here.
20% across the country, 13% in Chicago, the price increase, or the is that the value of the homes, or the increase in prices of properties that were sold?
It's the price of properties that were sold, which is, you know, the value. One of the things to keep in mind, of course, is that, you know, property taxes always happen in arrears for Cook County and even for the whole state of Illinois. You know, you don't see your property taxes go up in tandem right away as your property prices are going up. But this is something for homeowners to keep an eye on in a state which already has some of the most expensive property taxes in the country.
That's Elise Glink. You can find out more when you click on thinkglink.com. And she also co-hosts with Tom Fortino a little radio show called This Week in Wealth with Tom and Elise. That's Sunday mornings at 6:30. Good way to start your Sunday. Thinklink.com. Thank you, Elise.
You bet, John.
Philip Weiss joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the president of Seyfarth at Work. Philip, let's talk about salaries and the laws across the country, which in a lot of states now say that you need to advertise the salaries so that people don't get a sort of bait and switch when they go into work at a job, right?
Yeah, it's a really interesting phenomenon, John, one that we're seeing with increasing frequency over the last several months. Historically, talking compensation and salaries was considered poor form, impolite, whether it was your own salary or that of your employees. But that is gone by the wayside in a handful of states. New York City, Chicago is considering implementing a similar law in terms of what's called pay transparency. And as you said, John, in many cases, what this means is when you make someone an offer or you're considering them for employment, you got to give them the entire range of salaries that you are paying for that job for which they're applying or being hired. And in other cases, you got to post it in the job advertisement itself. So we're really in a new era today of increasing pay transparency.
What could go wrong, Philip?
Well, always something. That's why you and I are talking, because we talk when there's obviously a value to the law or the change or the trend. And it's admirable because more information about wages has, according to some studies, reduced disparity between different groups. And that is the goal here. But beyond being admirable, it's also created some angst among business owners who are not ready to communicate or deal with the reality of this information being out there, because once it's posted, employees are going to talk about it. So in one case, for example, a California wine company that we're now helping, the managers suddenly found themselves bombarded with complaints from employees who saw the posted salary for jobs that they all shared. And so the supervisors were hearing, what am I, chopped liver? Why do I get the bottom of the range? And comments such as, we can only imagine what you managers are getting paid if this is the top of the range. They really were caught flat-footed, John, simply because they weren't ready to address the fact that each salary is targeted to someone's performance, skills, and experience. So managers have got to be prepared to either refer the question or answer it if you can have increased pay transparency.
There should be some discrepancy on the part of the managers, right, Philip?
Yes. So this is a really great point. And even the laws that are extremely innovative or aggressive, depending on how you look at it, make clear if you have someone with the same title but more seniority, more skills, more contributions, you're going to immediately see these differences. So it's not as though you need everyone to be paid in lockstep, but the reality of now making more public the range means you have an obligation to be ready to explain why someone is paid what they are being compensated. In some cases, we have found that employees who were expecting the postings to start revealing the range actually took bets on who would be at the top and the bottom of the range. This is a company out in Colorado. And it caused a real morale drop and even a productivity drop when people realized they weren't paid what they had hoped vis-a-vis others. So it is important to be very clear on why this is happening and also be a little over-communicative with employees on what their position is, their contributions are, and their comp looks like and why.
Well, they don't grandfather in people that are already there, right? So it's not going to, if you've decided in the ad that a computer technician gets $72,000 a year and I'm getting 68, I could still be getting 68, right?
Well, the reality is when you look at a job, it's important to understand if it is the same job at the same level, we're going to be required to give the information and the range. But a lot of companies, to your point, are taking another look at how they define the job levels. Do they need to add additional levels that reflect someone's seniority and their contributions and their responsibility level so that we don't create this confusion between two people that are really doing different kinds of work, but we never took the time to look at their job title? And there's a whole field of data analytics, people analytics, that gives companies the opportunity to look at the jobs, look at the contributions, and make sure that the bands are correct and the titles are correct as well.
It does make you wonder what the dollar value is for somebody's contribution. We've got a whole swath of responsibilities. So how are we to determine that this job pays that and this other job pays that? That seems to be somewhat subjective, and maybe some people would say, you know what, I'm not making as much as the guy in that pay grade, but you lose me, this place shuts down, baby. So how about a little something for my contribution? I mean, it sort of brings the whole thing to light, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially given the pressure we're seeing on wages right now, John, given the competition for talent we're seeing, the fact that a company might want someone with so much more industry knowledge that even though they're in the same job as others, they're worth paying more. So there's no question some of these ranges are going to be probably significant. So that's something companies have got to be thinking about. The idea here is not to curtail the company's ability to pay different amounts, but it's about having a process that is clear, justified, studied, and we communicate it. And it's really fascinating because there's a lot of sort of contradictory messages for companies that don't pay attention. For example, you cannot ask an applicant about their salary history, even in those cases where you have to tell them the salary range. So the street does not flow in both directions. So in addition to the concepts you're raising, which is complexity of salaries, there's communication rules that companies have got to be very careful about because it may not be consistent if you're talking or you're listening.
It's fascinating. Philip Weiss, president of Seyfarth at Work. You can spell that Seyfarth at work.com. Seyfarth at Work. Nice to talk to you, Philip. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. John Williams here. Jim Dahlke, you'll appreciate this, senior editor at Chicago Inno. I just read your headline, Meet Cushy, a startup that wants to reinvent the crouton. And I have four bags of their croutons in front of me and just had one, and I thought it was really good.
Yeah, you know, it's not often I get to write about a crouton startup. It's probably the first, yeah. But I was pretty pumped to write about these guys.
Well, I don't know. So tell us about them. And by the way, it really did taste good. So this is the Cushy Crouton, and I had the sourdough bread, olive oil, sea salt, black pepper crouton. What's the deal with this company?
Yeah, so, you know, the funny thing about shopping for croutons is that they are, you know, an absolute necessity for your salad, but I can't even name a single crouton brand. It's, you know, it's like picking up toilet paper. You're just picking it up. You're not even thinking about the brand behind it. And that's what Cushy is really trying to change, and they're doing it through a couple of interesting ways. And one is flavor. Pretty much every crouton you've ever bought is sort of generally the same. This is just a garlic crouton. And really what Cushy is doing is kind of taking a different take on it. Yes, they have a garlic crouton called their Mambo Italiano, but they also have a spicy crouton called the Poco Picante. Got some chili and lime flavor to it. And it's got a sweet crouton. It's French toast crouton. It's got a little maple syrup flavor to it. And I think the one that you had, but it's more of a plain crouton, just sort of the salt and pepper version. So really what they, so their whole thing here is really to kind of bring some different flavor to the crouton space, but also taking it a different bread take too. So this is sourdough bread, like you mentioned. So that's very unusual. Most companies in the space are just sort of using generic white flour to create their crouton. So they're really taking a different approach with their sourdough bread. And it's a premium product. So they're really kind of trying to bring an elevated take to the crouton space. So the founders have got some interesting experience. One founder spent several years at Kraft Heinz. The other was the VP of finance at BuzzFeed for a couple of years. And so the Chicago brothers are really trying to change the crouton space, which the one of the co-founders told me was a stale category, pun very intended.
Yeah, no kidding. And are they baking these in Chicago then? Where are these made?
That's right. So they started at the Hatchery, which is a great space in Chicago and where a lot of food startups have gotten off the ground. So the Hatchery is a sort of a food incubator in town. Where a lot of Chicago's sort of early food successes get started. So there's a commercial kitchen space there where they can sort of tinker and work on their different flavor profiles and different ways to kind of bring their foods to life. So you got their start there in the Hatchery.
Okay, it's called Cushy, K-O-O-S-H-Y. You may see it on store shelves near you. And my review of the Almost Naked, that would be the basic one with just a little sea salt, black pepper, and olive oil on a sourdough bread one was very, very nice. That's good luck to them. Let's talk about film startup Showrunner. This is a headline, raises $4 million, moves their headquarters from New York to Chicago. What's the story here?
Yeah, so Showrunner, really interesting new startup in Chicago, just got $4 million in a round led by Lightbank, which of course is the VC fund in town led by Groupon founder Eric Lakofsky. What Showrunner does is they essentially are creating smart home technology for film sets. So thinking about the, you know, the ways that you might in a smart home kind of have one iPad that controls the thermostat and the lights and the locking of the doors. Showrunner is doing that for a film set. So where that's turning all the lights on, getting the cameras positioned, focusing lenses, really kind of bringing some automation to a film set. They're certainly big for indie filmmakers when, you know, directors are really strapped with their budget and maybe don't have, you know, the money to pay for an entire crew. They can kind of bring some smart home elements to the filmmaking industry there. You know, the big takeaway for me was that this company relocated to Chicago. So they were based in New York. This was technology that was built out of this founder's production studios, in-house tech that they're now commercializing and bringing to the market. They did a full rundown of where to move to because they wanted to get out of New York and move to a different city. And they looked at Mexico City, they looked at Utah, they looked at Atlanta, looked at LA, and settled on Chicago. The film incentives here were attractive to them. Real estate, getting into warehouse space was cheaper for them here. And there's a growing film scene here that they wanted to get in touch with. So Showrunner, really interesting new startup, planting their flag in Chicago with $4 million.
You also wrote about tech job postings in Chicago in general. What's the trend and how do we compare to the rest of the country?
Yeah, so pretty favorably. So, you know, Chicago from January to April of this year, there's been over 56,000 tech job postings in the city. That's up over 30% from the same time last year. Chicago was behind only New York, D.C., Dallas, and L.A. for tech job postings from January to April. So certainly quite a bit of hiring momentum in the tech sector, both in Chicago and nationally. However, many people are expecting a bit of a slowdown in the tech scene. We're certainly seeing that in the public markets as stocks have not fared well. There have been very, very few IPOs in recent weeks, and that trickles its way down into the venture capital space where deals are a little trickier to come by and valuations are a little bit lower. So some major tech companies like Uber, for example, said it's going to treat hiring as a privilege. Even Amazon says its warehouses are overstaffed. We've seen layoffs at companies like Netflix, for example, and locally in Chicago, we talked about Cameo, which laid off several dozen employees just the other week. So yes, the job postings are increasing, but much of the ecosystem is preparing for a bit of a slowdown.
We'll keep you posted on that, and they will at Chicago Window as well. Jim Dahlke, senior editor over there. Jim, let's talk again next week. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, John.
It is now 12:43. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Home prices are soaring despite rising mortgage rates. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Index for March shows a 20.6% annual jump in home prices. That tops the 20% gain the month before. Chicago home prices were up 1.5% month over month in March and 13% higher year over year. The Chicago area's streak of double-digit home price increases is now in its 11th month. Tampa, Phoenix, and Miami posted the biggest gains, with Tampa prices surging nearly 35%. Industry experts say demand remains high even as mortgage rates become more expensive. A large data center is another step closer to reality in Elk Grove Village. The village has purchased the site of a construction recycling business, the last parcel needed for the data center campus. Elk Grove Village will sell the land to a San Francisco company that's planning to build a $1 billion data center on the 24-acre site. The latest purchase was for $16.5 million, covering property at 1520 and 1700 Midway Court. Elk Grove Village previously acquired areas near the northwest corner of Higgins and Bussey Roads. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, about ready to flip the food calendar, Johnny, over to June. And May has been an exceptional month for food. Are you ready for this? National Beef Month, National Barbecue Month, National Loaded Potato Month, National Egg Month, National Hamburger Month, National Salad Month, National Salsa Month, and National Strawberry Month. That all happened over the last 30 days. Tomorrow begins June Dairy Month, and I'll talk some more about that in a minute. But first, I have a bonus edition of Mr. Fizz Friday. And if your body isn't too sore from doing yard work over the last few days, Jim has more work for you. And this is one of those cases, Jim, where something really pretty is really kind of nasty, isn't it?
Well, it is, Steve. Actually, this is a special warning about the Star of Bethlehem. It's a beautiful little plant with waxy white star-shaped flowers, maybe an inch in diameter, six petals on it. It's white with a little yellow center on the thing. It has strap-shaped little leaves that are maybe a quarter of an inch wide at most, with a little stripe up the middle of them. It's a magnificent little thing growing in the garden. Guess what? This is a horrible invasive plant, and it's listed on the list of invasive plants here in the United States, and it needs to be removed. Anytime you see it, get rid of it. It grows from a bulb that will be 4 or 5 inches down in the soil. Dig out all those bulbs, because if you don't get rid of it when you have a few of them, you will soon have many of them. And it is even so invasive that it will take over woodlands, prairies, so forth, and squeeze out anything else that's there. Get rid of it.
I think he means it. A stern Mr. Fizz. From our calendar, tomorrow begins June Dairy Month. All sorts of celebrations across the country, especially Wisconsin. It is America's Dairyland, don't you know? Over 40 farm breakfasts are on the schedule, and you can see that at wisconsindairy.org. And here's one with a sports connection. The name of the minor league affiliate of the Milwaukee Brewers will be changed from the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers to the Wisconsin Udder Tuggers. It's a one-weekend-only event, and this year it's this weekend in Appleton. The players will be wearing cow print uniforms, and the logo, the logo is magnificent. It's of an angry cow on her hind legs running after somebody who apparently tugged her wrong. I may have to order one of those caps. Now that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth, whatever about to report, I will tell you that I am one of the paying customers over the holiday weekend to have seen Top Gun Maverick.
Then you helped set this record. So Top Gun Maverick now has the record for the biggest opening over the Memorial Day holiday weekend. Previously, that was held by Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. That made $153 million in 2007. But Top Gun Maverick took in an estimated $156 million in the U.S. over the four-day weekend. So that really surpassed a lot of analysts' expectations. They thought the film would make closer to $80 million for the weekend opening, and then another $150 million over the holiday. But this is a big record. It's also Tom Cruise's biggest debut at the box office. It's the first time he's hit that $100 million opening mark. So wow, lots of records all around with this one.
And that's at the theaters only. That doesn't even include streaming. I don't know what their plans are for that. But if I'm not mistaken, right, Amy, that was at cinemas.
Yep, that's just cinemas, and that's just the four-day weekend. So we might look in another couple of weeks and see what the total run was and see if it kind of smashed some other box office records or something like that.
Rotten Tomatoes gives it 96. I do, too. I just thought it was so much fun. The first third, we don't have time for my full review, but the first third I thought was like, whatever. And then they got to the flying and the fighting, and it was a great summer popcorn thrill ride, I got to say. All right, now let's talk next about Spain. How is Spain in the news here?
My goodness. Well, you know how you call a customer service line and you get kind of stuck in this system of the phone tree, press one for this, press two for this, and you're like, well, I don't really need either of those things. I just need to talk to a person.
Yeah.
So Spain has proposed some legislation that would require companies to offer a real person, a customer service worker, when requested by a caller, which the minute I saw that, I with great interest, will be following this story immediately because, you know, I think we've all been there where we're kind of frustrated when we need to get something resolved, especially if it's kind of time sensitive. So this bill would still need to be approved by Spanish Parliament before it could become law. But I will be watching that with great interest because, you know, that can be a very frustrating thing. And in fact, some of the Spanish lawmakers said these are difficulties which unfortunately waste an enormous amount of time, energy, time and money. So I think we can all agree with that. So we shall see what goes down with Spanish Parliament here with this proposal.
Boy, you got to believe that'd be really expensive for an American company, though, with, you know,
certainly
millions of customers. How many operators do you have to have? But we don't have legislation like that in the United States.
We don't. We don't. You know, a lot of companies, when you call, it'll say, or press zero for an operator.
Yeah.
But even then, it'll say, what's the nature of your question? Press one for this, press two for this, and kind of keeps you in that system. And I get it. It really is a cost-saving measure, and it does help kind of triage calls to the right person. But, you know, if you're stuck, I think it's always helpful to talk to a human being. So we'll see what that means for Spain and what, if any, implications it might have here.
Speaking of the U.S., consumer confidence is where now?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important number to watch. So U.S. consumer confidence got a little lower in May. And so that's the view of present and future prospects, right? So that makes sense. It was probably dimmed a bit by inflation. So the Conference Board said earlier today that consumer confidence, the index dipped to just a little over 106 in May. That's still a pretty strong number. It was 108, a little bit over 108 in April. So again, still pretty strong numbers. Also, the present situation index from the same body that measures consumers' kind of assessment of current business and labor conditions, that also fell a bit in May. It was almost 153 in April, and now it's 149.6. The other one that continues to be kind of a weaker spot in the survey is the expectations index. So that's kind of based on what are consumers sort of what's the 6-month outlook, both for income, for business, for labor market conditions? Kind of what do you see in the tea leaves for the next 6 months or so? That also went down in May. It was 79 in April, and it was 77.5 in May. It was above 80 in February, and it's continued to decline. And not, you know, we don't see it up as high as the other two measures. So like I said, that continues to be kind of a weaker spot. But President Biden and Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, the economy is one thing on their agenda today as they're meeting to talk about this. So we'll see what comes from that meeting.
Elon Musk wants to have a restaurant chain.
I know, because he doesn't do enough. He needs to do more stuff. Indeed. So Tesla has filed paperwork with the city of Los Angeles with the plan of building a 24-hour facility that is a restaurant, a drive-in movie theater, and also a charging station, which is, when you think about that, a drive-in movie theater where you could just kind of charge your car. That's sort of an interesting idea. But these would not feature like a 2-hour movie. These would be 30-minute pieces of content because that's how long it takes to charge the Tesla battery. But it would be a restaurant and, you know, all this other, all this other kind of space to you know, do recreational or entertainment activities while you're charging your car. I think this is perhaps one way to address some of that range anxiety when people are kind of reluctant to go to an electric vehicle because they're like, well, I don't know if I have the charging infrastructure in my area yet. This is one type of facility that would help alleviate a little bit of that. But so far, the plan is just to have one in Los Angeles, and it would be 24 hours. So we'll see how that shakes out and what the timeline is.
Well, I hate to say this, but that sounds like a good idea. It's a little tail wagging the dog, but that makes sense. And that's all the time we have today, Amy. We'll visit again later in the week.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
That's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.